Covenant got a very rude awakening when the murder happened, because I'm not sure, you'd have to ask whether they had done background checks on students at that point. I don't think they had. And of course, now everybody's a suspect. So they background checked everybody and they found out they had students with very interesting backgrounds that they didn't know anything about. So yeah, things tightened up a good deal after that.
That's Diane Preston, whom you heard earlier in the series. She worked at Covenant Seminary for over 30 years, and she was good friends with Elizabeth before then. We've spent this series mostly focusing on Michael, Elizabeth's supervisor on the Covenant house cleaning staff. In the eyes of the police, Michael was the prime suspect in Elizabeth's death, literally from day one. But he wasn't the only person they looked at. In any large group of people, even at a seminary, there are going to be some people with checkered backgrounds. But as the police started looking into possible suspects, and Covenant began its own internal investigation, some startling things came to light. Not only about people's pasts, but things that were happening on campus around the time of the murder. This isn't just gossip and hearsay about people's personal lives. These issues raise serious questions about the kinds of people that Covenant Seminary was preparing for the ministry, and how seriously the police were looking into people other than Michael. So today, we'll start to examine some of the other people the police considered suspects, and we'll hear from another retired Creve Coeur detective with his own theories about the unsolved murder of Elizabeth McIntosh. This is True Believer, Episode 11, Shady Characters. A couple editorial notes before we get into it. First, in episode 9, Ruth and I were talking about Covenant President Paul Koistra believing that Michael may be psychologically abusing his children. In that episode, I said that this was the result of Koistra seeing Michael interact with his child Carl when the Koistras came over for dinner. In fact, that dinner took place at the Koistra's home, with Michael bringing his family there. So apologies for the mix-up. Second, we've mentioned this before, but we're mostly using first names to refer to the people involved in this story. There are some exceptions, such as people who have gone on the record with us, or anyone who has since passed away. We've also reached out to the men who are still alive for comment. Now, back in episode 4, you heard Detectives George Hodak and Dennis Spory mention that while Michael was their prime suspect, they did look into other men connected to Covenant Seminary. Here's that clip again, with them providing some additional context about the kinds of things that started to surface.
It was interesting that, how can I say it? It was interesting the type of people that were attending.
There were some strange people.
Yes,
that's interesting. That's a good way of saying it. Yeah, interesting, because they had some... I understand people get second chances, and a church will more than likely be the first ones to give someone a second chance. But they had some real characters.
Well, they had one guy who'd been arrested for rape
and
was acquitted, but then he did it again, and then eventually he went to jail for robbery and died when he got out of prison.
There were several people that had sexual...
And they had the head librarian dude,
right?
Him, and then there was a couple people in the dorm that were... hiding, having secrets and stuff. And there was just a bunch of... For a religious institution, it was hard to believe that they had those folks living on... or working and living on camp. Well, the headmaster, one of the guys, I don't even remember his name, shotgunned his dog. Yeah, shotgunned him, so that was kind of weird. So he had violent tendencies, obviously, so...
Yeah, so TJ, the police show up on campus and then they're sorting through all of these stories about people. And it becomes obvious pretty quickly, they've said before, there are some shady characters, they say, on campus. Well, what does that mean? That can mean all sorts of things. And so they're taking in these stories where somebody did kill their dog, which, okay, concerning, strange. They're getting stories from folks who say, I used to have a drug problem. Okay, is that relevant to this case? people are also talking about like sexual orientation and, oh yeah, I'm gay or I'm bisexual. Police are trying to figure out whether that's relevant to this case at all. And so we're really just sorting through all of these stories, and police are also hearing about people who had disagreements with Elizabeth. They find out that she had kind of small little fights with several people on campus. There is somebody who had a forgery conviction that they find out about. And then there are also people with more serious criminal issues in their past. So basically, they're just sorting through this deluge of information and trying to make sense of it.
So now that we've got the less serious stuff out of the way, we'll move on to some of the other people you heard Hodak mention. First is Eugene Smith. He started at Covenant in January 1989, and he was enrolled in the MDiv program. What no one apparently knew was that in 1987, Smith was arrested for attempted rape with a knife. Later that same year, he was accused of rape by another woman living in the same motel building as him. He was arrested by the police in a St. Louis suburb, and then he spent 6 months in the St. Louis County Jail. But neither incident resulted in a conviction. The day after Elizabeth's murder, the police interviewed Smith at St. John's Hospital, where he worked. Then later that same day, they brought him to the Creve-Coeur police station to be fingerprinted. On the drive to the station, one of the officers asked him if he had ever been arrested, and he said that he would rather not say. When they pressed him on it, he said that it was a long time ago. But as soon as they got to the station, the officers ran his record, and they learned about the 1987 rape arrests. Smith told police that he had classes with Elizabeth and that they would occasionally say hi to each other in passing on campus, but they never interacted socially beyond that. He claimed that on the morning of the murder, he woke up around 6:15 and that he was seen shortly after that by two other students in the dormitory kitchen. While these other students didn't specifically mention Smith in their interviews, the police don't seem to have specifically asked about him. When he was re-interviewed a couple weeks after the murder, Smith told police that he would cooperate as much as he could, but that he would not take the polygraph. He isn't listed in the Covenant student directory for the following year, and in 1993, he was convicted of armed robbery with a knife in Kansas City and sentenced to 5 years in prison. Eugene Smith died in 2006. The second person Hodak mentioned is a man named George, who had been Covenant's assistant librarian since 1978. In episode 5, we talked about the argument between George and Elizabeth in the library over lost and found items. George told police that he had last seen Elizabeth the night before her death, at Providence Church. Like many people the police interviewed, he witnessed Elizabeth having a conversation with their pastor, David Weinkauf. We'll talk more about that conversation in the next couple episodes. George also told police about an incident that took place when he was a student at Covenant in 1971. Just down the street from Covenant Seminary is Mercy Hospital, which back then was called St. John's, and that's where Eugene Smith worked. Incidentally, all of my children were born at that hospital. Anyway, George had gone over to the hospital to eat, presumably in the cafeteria, but at some point, a security guard found him hiding in a women's restroom with a piece of metal from a car engine. His plan was to knock out the first woman that came in, undress her, and fondle her breasts and genitals. Thankfully, the security guard found him before anything happened. The Creve-Coeur police were called and responded to the hospital, but no police report of the incident was made. Apparently, Covenant decided to address the issue internally. Dr. Eugene Holman, a psychiatrist and a member of Covenant's counseling department at that time, said the seminary thought that George had a breakdown and that they could help him. Remember that Holman was the same psychiatrist that later treated Mark Bells, and he also worked with Elizabeth during one of her counseling practicums. About a week after the murder, the police interviewed another woman named Anne, who was the wife of one of Covenant's professors. Anne worked part-time at the Covenant Library, and she had her own problems with George. She said that he would take every opportunity to touch her, that he did it deliberately, and that it got outrageous, as she described it. She said she finally communicated non-verbally to him that she didn't like him touching her, and he became hostile towards her. and felt like he disliked women that aspired to leadership roles. In terms of a possible connection to Elizabeth's murder, George's wife told police that he had been home all morning until he left for work around 7 a.m. And in his interview with police, George said that he never made sexual advances towards Elizabeth. Dr. Holman told police that he was sure George could not have committed the murder because he wouldn't have been able to plan out an attack and then plan a successful cover-up and escape. If George did commit the murder, Holman said, he would have confessed. Here's Ruth.
So, TJ, we've gone back and forth about how to talk about this particular person because it gets messy really fast and, you know, we want to be respectful of them as a person, but some of the details obviously are concerning. And so how do you kind of balance that? I do think, though, the part that stands out to me is this idea of Covenant had worked through an incident with him before where he was found in the bathroom and where he said he was thinking about maybe assaulting a woman. And so they wanted to give him counseling, which is good, but then apparently they let him work on campus, and I don't know what level of like oversight or checking in was ever done of, hey, do you still have these thoughts? Do you still have these urges? Did anybody else ever complain about him? So, I mean, what do you think?
I don't know. It's very messy and very complicated. On the surface, it doesn't look good that this incident happens in 1971, and Covenant essentially says to the police, don't file a report, we'll handle it. We'll give him counseling, we'll take care of it. And it feels very much like the opening scene of Spotlight, the film about the Catholic sex abuse scandal, where the priests are at the precinct and the two cops are talking and saying, hey, it's going to be tough to keep the press out of the arraignment. And the other cop says, what arraignment? And then both priests walk out, they get in the car, and the car drives away. And that's the end of that. And we know how the rest of that story played out. But George is also a very sympathetic character, I think. He's said some stuff to the police that we're not going to share publicly, but details about his past that this incident in the bathroom in 1971, I don't think was coming from a place of like malicious intent. I think he was a very awkward person. He was a very confused person. He seems to have had sort of a breakdown at the time that this incident happened. So, you know, how do you balance, okay, you have sympathy for someone on the one hand, but also then this person is working around other people in the same institution that knew that he had this incident. So how do you deal with that?
And we know that there were some people on campus, Elizabeth included, who didn't really like working around him. They thought he was strange. He would make strange comments. Somebody said that he would touch her inappropriately. So yeah, I mean, those are all things that we can and should be aware of and that the institution probably should have managed. But I mean, you and I and the police don't seem to think that any of those things connect him to Elizabeth's murder. And so we have to kind of figure out how to balance that.
One other thing that's worth mentioning, right around the time of the murder, George had been passed over for the library director position. At the time of the murder, he was the interim library director because the former library director, Joseph Hall, had left to go to Knox Seminary. They passed him over, apparently because they told him that they were looking for someone who was more extroverted and outgoing. George was more introverted. But it also makes me wonder if they didn't promote him to the head position, maybe because they knew about this and they thought, okay, we'll let the guy stay as an assistant, but given his past, we can't promote him. I don't know.
Yeah. There's no way to know for sure, especially since there was that gap in administrative leadership from the 1971 incident to the 80s and 90s.
Well, in the police report, George says that Brian Chappell was the one who communicated this to him. So Brian Chappell would know, but we have not been able to speak with him. Now, we'll move on to some of the other interesting characters at Covenant. The person who features most prominently in the 1990 police reports, aside from Michael, was another Covenant student named Larry. During their investigation, the police took fingerprints from the bathroom stall where Elizabeth's body was discovered. And one of the fingerprints matched Larry. When they questioned Larry about it 3 days after the murder, he said that it had been a week or two since he had used that restroom. But even then, he had not used the stall. There was some back and forth with the officers, but in the end, he could never explain why his fingerprint was in that stall. About a week later, the police contacted Larry at the seminary and asked him to come back to the station for a hair sample and a polygraph examination. Larry reacted very nervously, saying that he was too busy that day, but he did agree to meet them the following Monday. A note in the police report says, "He was obviously reluctant to speak to us." So on April 9th, the police picked Larry up and brought him back to the station. But when they got there, Larry said that he did not want to cooperate with the investigation and that he wanted to speak to his attorney. After several phone calls, Larry finally got a hold of the attorney, who advised him not to make a statement. But while all that was happening, the police at the station quickly got a search warrant to obtain a sample of Larry's hair. So they took the hair sample, but Larry didn't take the polygraph until 2 days later when his lawyer could be physically present. The test was administered by the same man that did Michael's test, Sam Yarborough, and his conclusion was that Larry was truthful and was not involved in Elizabeth's murder. The police also interviewed several Covenant students about Larry, including his roommates. He rented a room in a house owned by another Covenant student named Gordon, who more or less corroborated Larry's story that he had been in bed at the house until later on the morning of the murder. However, the roommates were mostly assuming that Larry was still in his room when they were up that morning. They had seen his car in the garage the night before, and they saw it again in the garage when they left for class that morning, but none of them could be certain that Larry didn't leave and come back at some point overnight. One female counseling student named Cheryl told police that Larry was suffering from depression. She said that he would try to talk to her about his depression, but when she would make suggestions for what he could do, Larry would get angry. He'd yell at her and then tell her never to speak to him again. This happened multiple times. And around the time of the murder, Cheryl was also receiving notes from a supposed secret admirer, but she told police that she thought the notes were coming from Larry. The two shared adjacent study desks in the library, and one of the notes said, "I saw your son's picture on your desk, and I know where he gets his good looks from." As far as Cheryl knew, Larry had no social life, no hobbies, and no relationship with Elizabeth McIntosh. In episode 4, we mentioned a man named Carmen, who told police about Professor Raymond startling Elizabeth in the chapel one morning while she was cleaning. Carmen doesn't seem to have been taking classes that semester, though he had apparently been on campus the week before the murder. The police first learned about Carmen from Brian Chapel, who called them about a week after the murder and said that they should look into him. Chapel told police that Carmen had told people that he cared for Elizabeth very much. He would get so worked up about her that he would start to cry. Someone else recalled a prayer group where Carmen said that he was thankful for Elizabeth and her smiling face. But Elizabeth didn't like those comments, and she refused to have any kind of relationship with Carmen. In his interview with police, Carmen admitted that he would compliment Elizabeth on her looks and her personality, but that he only did those things because he thought she had low self-esteem. His only interest in her, he claimed, was as a friend. And he had women in the past think that he was interested in them when he was just trying to be nice. Here's Ruth.
Yeah, so I think hopefully everyone agrees that a little bit of flirting is okay. And then as soon as somebody tells you they're not interested, you should stop. And there were definitely some people on this campus who, by all accounts, did not know when to stop. And so Carmen is a person in that category, I think, where it's kind of hard to tell from, like, you know, things written down 30 years later, whether it was all jokes or whether it was sincere. And then why didn't he stop when she said she wasn't interested? And apparently she was kind of more than not interested. She was a little offended and annoyed.
Understandably.
And was like, "I'm just trying to have my Bible study and do my work and do my homework. why do you keep bringing up my appearances? If that was me, I would very much be in Elizabeth's boat and be like, dude, stop. And so that's the main story there, I think.
Yeah, and that brings up another student whose name was Rod. And this is interesting both in terms of interactions with Elizabeth and then how the police investigated this. So Elizabeth and Michael's boss on the house cleaning staff was this guy named Tom. We've talked about him briefly before. When the police interview Tom, he tells them about a conversation that he had with this other guy, another student at Covenant named Rod. Rod apparently had been a prayer partner of Elizabeth's. Rod claimed that he was very close with Elizabeth and that she had told him that she was very disturbed about something to the point where she was crying and was physically afraid. The police then go to interview Rod. Rod doesn't say anything about it, and the police don't seem to ask him anything about it. Which seems crazy to me that you just had a lead that the woman who was just murdered told somebody she was physically afraid of something or someone, and the police don't specifically ask about that. Now, I guess it's possible that they did talk about it and it didn't end up in the police report, but that would seem like a pretty important thing to clarify when you had somebody earlier in the report mention that. So, two things about that. One is like the left hand didn't know what the right hand was doing with these detectives who were interviewing these people. And also, Rod is another one of these guys who told Elizabeth that he was attracted to her. Rod was married and had kids. And because of this, he said he found his working relationship with Elizabeth difficult because he was attracted to her. So this is another guy who's like, dude, get the hint, back off. And you're married. You shouldn't be doing this in the first place.
Lots of boundaries being crossed. Well, and another thing in that interview, right, is Rod didn't tell them about Elizabeth being afraid of someone. He more focused on, oh, she's a single woman. She said she's going to be like puritan marriage, and she really wishes she could be married. And that's what he focuses on. So, you know, I don't know what's going on with that, but I totally agree the police should have followed up on that story. Who was she afraid of on campus? And I think a lot of these people who had these passing comments should have been interrogated more closely as to either what they specifically or what this culture of everyone trying to date everyone might have led to. One other interesting thing about Carmen is Brian Chappell, at least, believed he was a mortician in Illinois who apparently would drive back and forth a lot from his dad's house, which I think was in Illinois, and a place where he would crash with roommates. And so Brian Chappell was basically like, hey, this is an interesting profession. I have no idea if it's relevant to this murder case, but you should probably look into it.
And the reason why Brian Chappell brought this up to the police is that he says because Elizabeth had been stabbed in the jugular vein, he knew that morticians use the jugular vein to drain the blood from bodies when they are doing embalming. So he's like, hey, I've got these kind of weird connections. Maybe you should look into this guy. I don't think Brian Chappell was specifically saying he suspected him, but he's kind of like, hey, this is a kind of an interesting flag. Why don't you check it out?
Right. Again, I mean, everybody on campus was basically throwing out everything they could think of, and this was one point of speculation.
The last person we'll talk about for now was a Covenant student named Uday. As the Major Case Squad was investigating the first week after the murder, they interviewed dozens of people on campus and asked them if they ever saw anything suspicious or suspected anyone. And more than anyone else, people named Uday as someone that they had concerns about. But at the same time, people also acknowledged that since Uday was from Nigeria, there could have been some cultural differences that explained his behavior. One former student I spoke with named Rob said that Uday would stare at people like he was violently angry. He looked at me like he wanted to kill me and everyone else around, Rob said. Elizabeth's roommate Chris told police that some people on campus didn't trust him, and some people called him a woman hater. But she added that Uday had always been respectful to her and to Elizabeth. One of the library assistants named Barbara told police that Elizabeth had been helping Uday in the library for a while. But at a certain point, Elizabeth felt like he needed to work on his own. Barbara thought that Uday may have been frustrated by this. She said that he was demanding, aggressive, rude, forward, and a frequently argumentative person, and that other women on campus were frightened by him. The last thing to say about Uday comes secondhand from another student the police interviewed named Thomas. He told them that Uday had a theory that maybe Elizabeth was killed because she saw homosexual acts in the bathroom. We're only mentioning it because this is another one of those whispered rumors that Ruth and I have heard numerous times from numerous people connected to Covenant, but for which there's never been a shred of evidence to support. I think that because Elizabeth's death was so incomprehensible, people were grasping for something, anything, to make sense of what could have led to someone killing her. And at Covenant Seminary in 1990, walking in on gay sex in the men's bathroom seemed like the most extreme thing that people could imagine. Finally, there was a series of odd phone calls that women at Covenant were receiving around the time of the murder. In her initial interview, Elizabeth's roommate Chris told police that the month before, Elizabeth was receiving wordless, annoying phone calls. According to Chris, it was almost like the caller could see that Elizabeth would be home. Because her schedule was so erratic, the calls couldn't have just been random. The caller would never say a word, just breathe into the phone. Elizabeth had asked her boss, Tom, who also managed the campus housing, what she should do about the caller, but he just told her to keep track of the calls that she received. After the police learned about this, they started contacting most of the other women enrolled at Covenant to see if they were also receiving similar kinds of calls. In total, 8 other women had been called over the last few weeks and months, and some were continuing to get the calls after the murder. One woman reported that a caller identified himself as Dave and then talked obscenely to her. But there's no indication in the police reports that they thought the calls were connected to Elizabeth's murder. So all this stuff started coming out as a result of the police investigation. And at the same time, Covenant was conducting their own internal investigation. Based on the internal investigation summary document, Covenant's attorney, Mark Bells, had advised them that 3 students should be dismissed from the seminary. None of them are named, but based on the context, we know that one of them was Michael. Then, in addition, Covenant dismissed 2 more students, both of whom had, quote, been involved in numerous serious violations of student rules and regulations. In addition, both students were seriously delinquent in payment of their student fees, unquote. Again, based on the context from some of the other interviews in the police report, we know that one of those students was Uday. Finally, Covenant fired George from his position on the library staff. Here's a sentence from the summary document. Quote, we had recommended that this employment be terminated, primarily because of his failure to respond openly and truthfully regarding previous criminal offenses in one of our interviews with him, although the seminary had other reasons in addition to that. Unquote. What those other reasons were, we don't know. And it's unclear whether or not anyone in the Covenant administration had known about George's history before it came out during the police investigation of Elizabeth's murder. As you heard, Dr. Holman was on staff at Covenant during George's hospital incident in 1971, but he left the seminary in 1985. We don't know if he ever told new administrators about George's past, or if there was anything in George's student or employee files about the incident. Dr. Holman died several years ago. Here's Ruth.
Yeah, we've said a few times that, you know, seminaries and churches should be places where people with, you know, past trauma, past mistakes, past misdeeds should be able to come, learn about Jesus, learn how to act better, learn how to work with their community in the future. And that was very much Covenant's perspective in 1990. The issue, I think, that we recognize now in hindsight is that they weren't always really discerning with who then could be prepared for a job in ministry and who they would be like, you know, okay, so these past things probably really disqualify you from working with people in this capacity. And so the challenge is sorting through who is a shady character in connection to the murder investigation and who was just kind of like a strange person on campus. And that's what we are still working through today.
Yeah, the psychiatrist, Eugene Holman, who treated George and also later went on to treat Mark Bells. When the police interviewed him, they were asking him about his perspective on the murderer, like a psychological profile of what that kind of person would be like. And he was talking about the different people on Covenant's campus. And he said this to them, and I want to read this quote because I think it's a pretty good encapsulation of everything that we've been talking about. So he says, "A large number of seminary students have sexual troubles. They will escape to seminary hoping to either get answers to their problems or hoping that their sexual inadequacies would disappear. They then learn to hide their problems, but the problems are still there. The training they undergo leads to more stress about their problems, which leads to deepening depression." So it's like these guys are coming to seminary. We can't say all of them, but some number of them seemingly not because they want to go into the ministry and they have a calling to lead a congregation or these kinds of things. They're thinking like, okay, I'm going to go to seminary to fix my issues. And that might not be the best motivation to go to seminary.
Totally agree. Well, and if I can just add to one added layer of all of this that I think is important to note without getting too into the weeds about it. So there were some people with past legal issues. There are also some people on campus who had what the seminary would consider to be moral issues. And the biggest thing that stands out to me is some men said that they were attracted to other men. And at Covenant Seminary and the PCA in 1990 and today, that would mostly disqualify you from being a pastor. And so they had to keep that a secret. And the question I always wonder when you have to keep a certain taboo thing a secret from everyone and everything is that increases the likelihood of personal distress and of things possibly going wrong and of social stigma of somebody saying, hey, I think you're a bad person and a bad pastor because of this thing about you. And so that's just an added layer to all of this that was present then and that we have to kind of figure out how to factor in without claiming that gay people are murderers, because that's not true either.
And I think it's analogous really to this entire series. We've talked so much about how it seems like Covenant wanted Elizabeth's murder to go away. They didn't want to talk about it. We've heard various, you know, some people talked about it on campus. Some people got the impression that it was a thing you're not supposed to talk about. So it kind of got buried. It went underground. People who attended Covenant very shortly after the murder never heard about the murder until they listened to our podcast. And we probably wouldn't be doing this podcast if Covenant had been more open and talked about it. So when you bury something, it grows and it festers, and eventually it's going to come out in ways that you didn't expect and probably didn't want.
Well, and the speculation is harmful, too. Like, so these people we're talking about in this episode, we're not talking about them in order to dig up, you know, nastiness. We're actually hoping that this will stop some of the speculation and let some people move on with their lives and just have a little bit of a weight taken off, if possible.
So those are some of the people, other than Michael, that the police looked into in 1990. Some were never really taken seriously as suspects. They were just flagged in the investigation because of odd or concerning behavior. And it's unclear how much of that odd and concerning behavior Covenant Seminary was aware of at the time. It's also worth saying that in the PCA, Covenant Seminary is not the final authority on who does or does not get ordained into the denomination. In most cases, it's the responsibility of the presbytery to approve or reject a pastoral candidate. Covenant could help or hurt someone's chances with a good or bad recommendation, as you heard in Michael's case, but they aren't the final gatekeeper. One PCA pastor I spoke with said that we could think of it this way. The seminary trains, the church calls, and the presbytery approves and ordains. But regardless of how questionable their behavior may have been, none of the men we've talked about in this episode seem to have had a strong motive for wanting to kill Elizabeth. But what if the police in 1990 missed something? Almost a quarter century later, another detective picked up the case.
I spent 2.5 decades in law enforcement. And prior to that, I worked a couple of years in corrections in a prison system. I worked for a metropolitan police department in the St. Louis area, where I spent just under a decade as a detective, working many types of different investigations. I have a bachelor's degree in justice and law administration. Prior to that, I served in the military.
That's Detective Scott Wirth. He was with the Creve Coeur Police Department from 1999 to 2020. And starting around 2014, he did a deep dive into Elizabeth's case. Over the next few episodes, you'll be hearing from Detective Wirth about different aspects of what he discovered and the theories he developed. Here, he talks about the state of the case when he got into it and how he approached it.
The state of the case is it was colder than cold. Like, it was basically untouched since I had been there. And from reading the case file, I read the case file multiple times because I wanted to become intimately aware of everything in the case file and intimately aware of every piece of evidence, whether we had or we didn't have. Intimately aware of what everybody said during the investigation. And I became involved in it in 2014 when a former attorney contacted our chief of police, and myself and another detective fielded that call with that former attorney from the seminary, and we took it from there. But I always liked a challenge. I never veered away from a challenge. I thought it was disappointing that there was no movement or nothing being done, not even a try or an attempt. Also, I like a challenge. Whether or not I'm going to win or lose, I don't care. I'm willing to battle, you know, and that's what I wanted to do when I took on this case. And that's basically why I got involved, just because I'm a competitor. If you're a detective and you're not a competitor, I don't want you working my crime scene. I'm willing to take on that challenge and roll up my sleeves and do all the necessary things. And no matter how grueling it is, even if you have to start over, which I, for all intents and purposes, did when I started looking at this case.
You heard Detective Wirth say that he got into the case because a former attorney from Covenant Seminary called the Creve Coeur Police, and that he fielded that call. We're going to talk a lot more about it in a future episode, but for now, just keep in mind that that attorney was Mark Bells. Did you get any pushback by digging back into the case?
Yeah, I got some pushback. And I also basically directed, like, hey, you don't need to solve this. Like, because I think there was some embarrassment factor about how evidence was handled in the past on this case and whatnot. And there was some political pushback to not get involved. And I even had one particular supervisor say, so what now? So, you know, your search warrant didn't yield anything. So what now? Like, basically, like, see what you did? Like, you created a whole bunch of circumstances and you didn't solve it. You know, these things, anybody that works murders knows the peaks and valleys of a homicide investigator. If you can't hold on, you're in the wrong game, because there is a whole bunch of peaks and valleys. There's days when you're going to be like, whoa, this is really promising. And then all of a sudden you're going to have your hopes dashed, right? So there was political pushback, like, and then I was basically told not to do one of these search warrants that I did in this thing. And I'm like, well, what are you going to do? You're going to tell me that they're going to issue a search warrant and you're not going to let that happen? Like, are you really saying that? Is that what you're saying? And they wouldn't say that, but there was a little bit of that going on too.
And so when you dug back into it, you kicked over a bunch of rocks that hadn't been looked at yet.
Right.
Did you talk to new leads? What did you discover that maybe hadn't been looked at yet?
Well, there was a whole litany of things that hadn't been looked at yet. I started discovering things on the case that, like, so I just made a pact to myself, like, hey, this doesn't seem right. Like, let's just start over. Let's just take it from day one and start running interviews all over from scratch, because there are people that had edited things that were said by potential, you know, witnesses or whatnot. So I just took it from day one, and basically I took it from scratch and just started interviewing people all over again. And there was a few particular people that stood out to me that I wanted to interview and talk to and determine, and that's what I did.
So when the police arrive, I mean, I'm assuming that in 1990, collection of DNA wouldn't be to the standards that we would use today, or they didn't use DNA evidence as much as they use today. So what would have been, in terms of evidence collection, the way that they handled the crime scene, talk me through what they did, what they should have done, and the difference between what's understandable because we just had different standards back then, or things that maybe they should have known to do anyway, even though it was in 1990.
Yeah, in 1990, I can't speak to that because I wasn't an officer in 1990. I was later on in 1995, but what they would have done is they would have tried to maintain the scene regardless and photograph the scene in place before people actually entered the scene. And they would be focusing more on things like fingerprints in 1990. Nowadays, we focus on a lot more than that, like skin, urine, blood, semen, hair, fingerprints still too, but we're more DNA orientated in the law enforcement world than we were in 1990. There wasn't a known collection process that St. Louis was using in 1990 for DNA. So that's the things they would have done differently. They would have taken specific items to DNA. Like, for example, I remember earrings on the floor in the bathroom. I think there was some sort of jewelry in a lecture hall that was adjacent to the bathroom in the basement where they originally believed that she was accosted and then dragged into the bathroom or taken into the bathroom. And that's where the presumed electrical cord came from, was from an audio video cart in that lecture hall, just adjacent to the bathroom. So there's a side entrance to that lecture hall, and there's also one down towards the bathroom. It's literally, you take a right out of that outside door and you're right there at the bathrooms. And there's a janitor's closet right there to the left of the bathrooms. So that would have been the main things. Like they would have probably bagged her hands, and they may have still bagged her hands, right? Because they did concentrate on some fingernail clippings back then, but later it didn't prove evidentiary, or DNA's came a lot farther than it has now. Like the testing and some of the machines that they use to test for DNA are a lot better now than they used to. But unfortunately, maybe they had something on a fingernail, but it was so small, it wouldn't have worked under the old means of testing for DNA. But in a new system, in a new machine, it would have worked. But they may have already priorly used that total sample that they can no longer run a test because it was used. So I know I came across that one time when we were investigating this case, that there was a blood sample, but there was literally only enough to run one test without a confirmatory test. And it didn't prove anything, you know, great, but had we needed to test it again, there just would have been no more evidence to test because it was so minute. So that's the major things that would have been done nowadays compared to in 1990. And I just think the police are better trained nowadays than they were in 1990.
When Detective Worth reopened the case, part of the problem was that there was little to no physical evidence for him to work with. Most of the samples that had been collected in 1990 had already been used in previous tests. Here, he talks about some hairs that were found on Elizabeth's body at the crime scene, both human and animal hairs, and how those hairs may have gotten there.
In police work, you have the theory of transfer, right? Whenever you go into a scene, you take something with you into that scene, and when you come out, you take something out. And that's what we were thinking that the suspect did, is through the theory of transfer, he transferred hairs on Elizabeth unknowingly when he committed this act and left the scene through the theory of transfer. Well, you also have the theory of transfer being that You're in a bathroom, okay? A men's bathroom, to say the least. And everybody's been in public restrooms, right? And they're just horrible, right? And there's DNA everywhere. There's hair on the floor. There's urine on the floor. You don't know who brought in what, if it was the bad guy or it was already there, right? So through the so we're dealing in a petri dish for a crime scene already that could have been there. And through the theory of transfer, she just picked it up through falling on the floor.
Right.
Or through cleaning. She's a cleaning lady, too. No telling where she picked it up.
Right.
She could have picked it up in another room.
Mm-hmm. And so even if you got a positive match, it probably wouldn't be admissible because...
It wouldn't be indicative without other corroborating evidence. It might be, you know, one particular, you know, piece, but without other things to align it with, it really wouldn't be evidentiary. It wouldn't be enough to prove or disprove whether or not it belonged to a killer without other corroborating information. For sure not.
Now, if you found blood, let's say, you know, in that bathroom that wasn't Elizabeth's, there's not normally a bunch of blood on a bathroom floor, but because you only had hair, you only had a small amount to work with.
Well, it's really hard to say under that circumstance because there could even be a reasonable reason for blood. Like if you cut yourself, surely when you go into the bathroom to go get some paper towels and put some water on it,
right,
to put pressure on. Like now, if I would have found a weapon with blood on it and then blood on that knife that wasn't Elizabeth, that would be more indicative, right?
Right.
Certainly that would. Or touch DNA on that weapon and then Elizabeth's blood on that weapon or something like that. Or DNA on the electric cord that was used to, you know, strangle her. That would be more indicative, at least because that would be harder to explain, right?
But we don't have any of that.
We don't have any of that. None. No. So... yeah, it's a worst-case scenario for a detective because you have really, really bad evidence. The only thing you have in this particular case is a couple fingerprints, but they could have been laid there without malintent, meaning just through normal circumstances, we pulled a print. It doesn't mean it's the bad guys. You got to have other corroborating things.
Right.
A fingerprint is really nothing without being able to prove they weren't allowed there, or it was, you know, you'd have to have more, a confession, an eyewitness, something else. That's not enough in and of itself. Is it evidentiary? Sure, it is. Is it enough to raise an eyebrow? Yes, but I'm sure there have been many people in that bathroom. And to say whether that fingerprint, that we found a fingerprint in the bathroom, we also found one on Elizabeth Knox seminary admission letter.
Which matched David Weinkauf.
Right. But we couldn't say when that happened. I couldn't give you a date because fingerprints can be there a really long time or they could be there a really short time. We can't time date stamp them. We don't know. Criminal justice system has not came that far that we could, you know, time date stamp a fingerprint. We just know through the theory of transfer, it happened, right?
33 years later, is there any evidence that could turn up that you think could conclusively solve this case short of getting a confession out of someone?
Sure, I think there could be evidence that could show up.
What would that be?
What if someone comes forward and says this is the murder weapon and it's got Elizabeth's blood on it and then it's got the DNA of the killer? That'd be huge. We still don't got the murder weapon per se, one of the murder weapons. They surmise it was a pair of scissors, but no one's been able to quantitatively say where that is or where, I mean, that could happen.
Right.
Sure, that could happen. We could have another witness come forward that maybe took a secondary confession from somebody wherein we could corroborate that information, right? We have had people come forward to say, hey, I think this person did it. I think that person did it. I mean, that's the whole reason why we went down the trail of chasing the lead of David Weinkauf. Because we had someone come in and say, hey, I think he killed this person. But legally, we couldn't prove it. Like, there was enough to maybe raise an eyebrow there, but there was a lot of eyebrows to be raised in this case, period.
One of the things that I've heard, one of the rumors floating around out there, definitely from the PCA side, is basically that the police botched the evidence and screwed up the case. Is there any truth to that? Was there mishandling of evidence? Could they have done things better that could have facilitated solving this case?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, and now you're talking about a 33-year-old case. There's probably not a police department in the country that can say, hey, we've held our evidence in a pristine condition forever and ever. Police practices were not very good. And police nowadays, they're beat up a lot more in the press and whatnot, but they're more highly trained, more highly skilled, more highly educated than they've ever been. And you're talking about 33 years ago. Yeah, there's evidence that was botched in this case. There's probably evidence that was lost in this case. There was probably evidence that was never turned in and filed in this case. Sure. And by being in charge of this case later on, I can say that. I can say that succinctly. Like, there's missing items in this case. Like, I can't say they were on an evidence sheet in the missing, but maybe they should have been on an evidence sheet and seized, and they weren't, right? I mean, some of the reasons for some of the evidence being gone is explanatory, because we tested all the evidence. You know what I mean? Like biological evidence, like we tested fingernails, they get destroyed in the process of testing or whatever. Or blood samples. There's explanatory reasons why that type of evidence would be missing. But there's plenty of other things that I could point to in this case by working it and being like, what the heck, man? Like, are you kidding me? Like, this is unacceptable, bro. Like, this is a homicide. Like, we don't operate this way. Like, if you're going to keep a checkbook, you got to keep it clean. Like, you know, this is not how we operate when we, but like I said, the practices and principles of policing have changed in 33 years. Guys and gals that have never worked a homicide, or an agency that's never worked a homicide, and then all of a sudden they're worked one. Mm-hmm. And then, I mean, cataloging the evidence is in itself a chore, like in order to do it right. Like, there's a lot of things that go on there and things that should have been done right, and like, but that comes with time and experience and training, and unfortunately there's probably not a police department in the country that doesn't have a case where they're like, oh man, where's that at? How come that wasn't seized? Or where's that at now? Like, or worse yet, they've had a fire in their evidence room or something. Like unexplanatory, that just zap their evidence, like whatever they had is forever gone, right? So, yeah, there could have been things done better for sure.
To me, that feels like a pretty good summary of this entire series. There could have been things done better for sure. So, now that you've heard about some of the suspects the police looked into in 1990, and Detective Wirth's opinions about how that investigation was handled, it's time to move forward to 2014, and some new suspects and new theories that had never been considered before. Next time. True Believer is written, recorded, edited, mixed, and executive produced by TJ Ingracia. Co-written and co-produced by Ruth Servin-Smith. Research and development by Kyle Hackman and Doug Servin. Visit TrueBelieverPodcast.com to see additional materials related to each episode, or to get in touch with us. If you're someone who knew Elizabeth, or have any information related to her or her murder, we'd love to hear from you. Next time on True Believer.
Somewhere along the line, again, we interviewed so many doggone people today that they thought that maybe you were kind of interested in Elizabeth.
Interested?
Yeah.
I've been here probably my whole life.
Why wouldn't you say that?
I don't know.
How do you find that funny?
There wasn't any. No, there wasn't anything like that.
I became very, very interested in finding out when different people knew. If you can find someone who knew sooner than everybody else, then that's the person you kind of hang on to and go after.
The purported revenge was that Elizabeth apparently went over Michael's head about not having enough cleaning supplies on hand for her to do her job as a night janitor, right? I didn't think that was enough of a reason, so I started going through the case and I found other means that I thought there was other reasons that were stronger than this one to have ended in her demise.